tyranny of Caesar, with his policy to seize him and bag him and tag him and besmirch their records. This is Earthwatch on WBAI in New York, and we're on the website at WBAI.org. We've been doing programming on the technotronic state, and what many years ago we spoke of, thinking it was only mainly in England with the proliferation of observational cameras. And at the time, we called it data valence or data valence. And here we are now, in a world of total observation compounded by digital narcissism. How many fools been trapped up because of Facebook or LinkedIn or any of the others, Google, Gmail, and so on? We have come into such a thing with the Obama's approval of the Patriot Act and the Democrats voting like reactionaries and the Republicans voting like reactionaries to what Robert Anton Wilson called optimal mind. And it means the overload of information, which is why the NSA is now building a supercomputer farm in Utah to analyze all the stuff they don't admit that they have to analyze. If you leave your house with your cell phone turned on, you are bait. You know why they call it a smartphone? Because it's not for you to have one. I'm just saying, you know, it's your judgment on the threshold to privacy that you choose to have in your life. But do know the consequences and the jeopardies involved therein. And don't have time to fully explore the subject, but this is just a thought that comes to an innocent mind. I remember a long time ago speaking with a very good and dear friend of mine, Aisha Jahada. We were astrologers then, and spiritual consultants for some very large enterprises. I think she's with Essence now. And we spoke about what in the mythology we call the Akashic Records, which is a spiritual concept of a silver thread that is sort of like a magnetic recording of every event, fact, emotion, decision of the life of a soul. And we were taught that we should live life as if the Akashic Record were a universal tentacle exposed and visible to all. Now that was a pretty high standard, and we tried to live up to it, being spiritual. But now, people can only live up to it in terms of legal liability. For when the evil mechanics of prosecution selectively choose from your digital Akashic Record. And the more each day that fake president and the false party of liberals pretend to support and protect us, the more I see how vulnerable we are. Perhaps most of all because we believe those two entities really mean to help us. Well, you know, it's like Ivory versus Procter & Gamble. Two competing products. One of them makes you fear the other, which is why I will never vote for the evil of two lessers. But here's what's on my mind. I'm thinking that someday that we will have to consider life as being part of the Akashic Record. And I think we're at a threshold of...
Earthwatch was brought to you on recording, but it is nevertheless WBAI New York. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With us, we have, well, not a slew of people, but three, two of whom are going to be talking, Sam Miller and Jen Brissett. And, well, we're going to be talking about reading and reading about talking, and, well, just stay tuned. Good morning. Again, this is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. And yes, I've mentioned names that you may or may not be familiar with. Sam Miller is, well, I can't actually do a proper bio of him. So in just a minute, he's going to do that for himself. Jen Brissett, I know, had the coolest effing bookstore in Brooklyn for a number of years, is how I first knew of her. And that is where some really dynamite, wonderful readings occurred. I had the incredible, vast honor to accompany one Octavia Butler-like person to just take a quick tour of the store. She and Betsy Mitchell and myself. We were in there like 5 minutes. What book? You didn't know this?
No. I didn't know this.
How could you not know this? No. Who was at the cashier?
I might not have been there.
Oh, well, that could be.
Oh, man.
It's hard to miss that woman. She was a big woman.
Yeah, I would have. Oh, God. My God.
Yeah.
Really?
It was very, very brief. She was on her way to a reading. She was at my house where we had recorded an interview.
Oh, man.
And she was being ferried around in a car service from, she was being driven nuts.
There's a few people who came to the store and I didn't know about, and I found out later, like Stacey Ann Chin. And,
yes. And what was the name of the bookstore?
Indigo Cafe and Books.
Yeah. Yeah, hold on. Say that again.
Indigo Cafe and Books.
Okay, let's try it a fourth time.
Indigo Cafe and Books.
No, take that microphone. Pull that microphone closer to you and say it now.
Indigo Cafe and Books.
Oh, okay, now we're almost, if you can pull that mic to you or move over a little. How's that?
Okay.
Oh, yes, there you are. Hello, Jen. How are you? Now I can see you.
Yay.
Okay. At least we have a working bleeping mic before we get out of this church. Oh, that's a secret. Anyway.
Okay.
So, but with the exception, now, if I had wanted to do a panel just on readings in New York, either Ellen Datlow or Matt Kressel, run the KGB Fantastic Fiction reading series, should be here as well. And perhaps Eric Rosenfeld, whose Wold Newton reading extravaganzas are on again, off again kind of thing.
Okay.
But he hasn't had one in at least 6 months. He was doing that at Word for a while. Word Books in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
But we are here to discuss the thing that is closest to my heart, which are readings. because, well, that's always been, since Margot Adler started this show in 1972, has been much of the premise of this program, has been, let's listen to a story. And, I keep going, you know, reminiscing, saying, yes, when Margot started the show and I was her engineer, Adler did 5 days a week. And 2 days a week were the science fiction mornings. And in those mornings, I was her co-host. So, and also procurer to a certain extent. She knew a lot of writers and all that, but I was a fannish kid in the community, so I brought a few more. And then she left the show, this becomes relevant, for 6 weeks in order to go to the Pacific Northwest. 1974, Clarion.
Yeah.
Few people realize that Margot Adler of National Public Radio is a Clarion graduate. And they don't realize that because she's never written fiction. Are you listening, Margot? Are your friends listening? Will people say, hey, Adler, write some fiction because it'll be great. But anyway, she just finished a nonfiction book.
Okay.
About vampires. So sort of qualifies, but not quite. And still a sociology book. It's not a... Anyway. So readings have been a major thing for me. When I came here to BAI, Baird Searles was our drama and literature director. We didn't have an arts department. We had a D&L and separately a music department. Then they combined them. Then they just, you know, threw them all out the door because somebody got the weird idea that arts and and politics don't necessarily coincide. But actually, I think part of the point of this show, not the point of the show, but what will emerge from this show is that, in fact, you cannot separate the two.
I believe that.
Yeah, I completely believe that.
Yeah. And the same would be true for with the reading series that I produce, even though mine is not themed other than speculative fiction. Mm-hmm. It's the New York Review of Science Fiction readings. But, well, as things turn out, we do much more fantasy than we do science fiction. Our family-oriented evening is I have the same family every year, although I'm trying to add to it a little, but the married couple who I have are Ellen Kushner and Delia Sherman.
Mm-hmm.
And so, well, qualifies. And I believe I'm not the only person to try to book them for a reading.
I'm afraid not. I'm afraid I stole them because they're just too marvelous. They'll be reading on January 7th at Blue Stockings Books at the reading that I'm organizing.
And Blue Stockings Books is, okay, oh yes, everybody at home, pencil and paper. It's not that there's going to be a quiz. It's just that you're going to be going, oh my God, with all of this wealth in New York, I know what I'm going to be doing. So I'm telling you now, pencil and paper. Blue Stockings is located...
It's at 173 Allen Street on the Lower East Side, just two blocks south of Houston Street. You can take the F train to 2nd Avenue. It's right by Katz's Deli, which is a delightful place to go after
overpriced,
a reading.
Overpriced.
A bit overpriced and a bit too full of themselves. But
yeah, exactly. It's like, yeah, okay, do we have to do the orgasm scene there?
Yeah, exactly.
Nora Ephron.
However,
cast a pall on that place.
I will probably say this several times in the next 90 minutes, there will be candy at my reading. I am a firm believer in feeding people when I organize an event. So folks who are on the fence about science fiction, there's candy.
Come for the candy.
There's candy.
Yeah, forget the science fiction. Forget the gay theme.
Yeah.
It's...
Forget Katz's Deli.
Forget Katz's Deli. Although there are other places near there that I... Because my reading series is right near there as well. And over by Blue Stockings, there are a couple of kanji palaces that are really worth knowing about and easy on the wallet.
Good to know. One of my favorite restaurants in the city is the Punjab Deli, which is on Houston Street, just a couple blocks from there. And that's where all the cabbies go. So
yeah.
It's really cheap, really good food.
Yeah. Exactly. It's BAI-worthy food.
Exactly.
Now, you don't have a reading series, per se. You're simply hosting a reading.
Correct.
Curating, correct. As I call it.
Yes.
What do you call yourself, Jen? Are you a curator? Are you a producer?
I call myself a curator.
Yeah. I took the word curator. I know exactly from whom. The New York Review of Science Fiction Readings has had any number of people through the years. It was founded by Gordon Van Gelder. I was there from the beginning recording it.
Mm-hmm.
But it went through him and somebody else and somebody else. And then some unknown entity by the name of Cherie Renee Thomas became the curator, became the producer for 2 years. And I was her co-worker. And she introduced for me the word curator.
I have a feeling she did the same thing to me.
Yeah, I think there's a lot that woman has to answer for. And I think introducing that word.
Yeah.
Sam, how about you? How would you give us a little of your background? Who am you anyway?
Who am I? This is a very profound existential question for 1:45 in the morning. I'm a writer and a community organizer, and I just recently graduated from Clarion 2012 at UCSD, which was phenomenal. And for all the folks who are on the fence about it, I know the significant time and money investment kept me from applying for a couple of years, but it really truly is worth it. It's like the greatest experience you'll ever have. So there is an application process going on now, I believe, and I strongly encourage folks to do
and
that.
And Clarion and the Odyssey Writing Workshop and all these really great workshops need help. And there are, for people who can't afford Clarion, there is the Brandon...
Well, there's the Carl Brandon.
That's it.
But actually, it's the Octavia Butler Scholarship.
Her again?
Yes, her again.
Which facilitated my roommate Lisa's participation in Clarion this year, and she's a phenomenal writer who has a story coming out in an anthology of Butler-inspired work that was one of her Clarion stories. So the Octavia Butler Scholarship and the Carl Brandon Society is doing really good work with that.
Yeah, and the Carl Brandon Society is basically, I guess, a scholarship fund and a promotional idea to encourage people of color to be writing more skiffy.
It's a way of us communicating, knowing about each other. We have a message board that we communicate with, and we do sponsor some events sometimes. We're still sort of in the figuring out all the different things that we can be, sort of. It's sort of a grab bag of everything, but
yeah.
We really are just a group of science fiction fantasy writers
because
of color.
There was a time when you had to have money to go to Clarion because it's 6 weeks long. And you have to be able to not be at work for those 6 weeks. B, fly to the West Coast, or is there still one in Michigan?
No.
So Michigan
is
gone.
That's USD now, I believe.
Right, so it's UCSD in Seattle.
Okay, and Australia.
Yes.
There's Clarion South.
The word is that's on hiatus. I'm not sure.
Oh, dear.
That might be another secret.
Yeah.
We didn't hear that.
Yeah, okay. We did not say Jack Dan.
We didn't say that on the radio.
Let us know. No. Yeah. No, this is WBA.
I could be
but
wrong.
Anyway.
Yeah.
But look it up, find out. Also, I'm planning on doing a show at some point from the Odyssey Writing Workshop, which I think is in Maine. But the point is that you used to need to be slightly affluent. Or have somebody pay for you to be able to take what amounts to being the 2 months off, not to mention the fact that I think you have to write a story to get into Clarion.
Yes.
And then, of course, you have to write during Clarion.
A story a week.
It's
a grueling process.
Yeah. I was accepted to Clarion. I did not go.
It's never too late.
Yeah, it is. Well, who knows? Who knows? But I had two choices, and this is me again. I could either go to Clarion in the same year and the same time that Margot Adler went, or I could substitute for her show, Hour of the Wolf.
Well, and look where you are now.
And yes, and look where she is now, running NPR. But well, NPR correspondent, but. Had I gone, maybe I'd be an NPR correspondent. Oh. But she isn't doing any skiffy now. I'm unpaid but happy.
Oh. Amen.
But she pays her rent. Anyway, so tell us a little bit more about you and why you're hosting or producing or creating.
Curating. Perhaps.
I like curating.
Let's go with that.
Yeah.
So the reason that I'm curating this event of LGBTQ science fiction and fantasy writers is that it's a lot. So the acronym is quite long.
I hope everybody at home, if you're watching your radio closely, you see me raising my eyes to heaven. It sounds like a sandwich with extra stuff on it.
It's true. It is a mouthful. But the thing that really appeals to me, I think that most folks who come to science fiction, many of them come from an outsider perspective. And that might be because they're a nerd. It might be because they come from a different background than most folks. And I think that that really is one of the things that appeals to folks about science fiction. So for me, that being a lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender, I think is a natural fit for so many of the things that science fiction does, and being able to imagine other worlds where these crazy different identities are normal or are possible. So that's part of why I think being queer is actually kind of science fiction. It's actually my belief that being gay is a superpower, and that I and many others are blessed with that.
I just have this image of somebody, you know, holding the two lavender bracelets together, put kazam, you know.
It's correct. It's yes. Correct. So that was the main thing, but
any character that has come out in comics or science fiction has been castigated for it. There was an actor who played The Flash somewhere in the 80s, and it was a really good show, and it got good ratings. And then the guy came out, and that was the end of the show.
Well, Gandalf is gay. Magneto is gay.
Ian McKellen is gay.
Gandalf.
Magneto is definitely gay. I will fight anyone who says otherwise. He is an LGBT Malcolm X who does not want to assimilate into society. He wants to remake society.
Okay, you're talking about you're not talking about the Kevin Bacon Magneto.
Definitely not.
Definitely not. Yeah. Ian McKellen was on Doctor Who on Christmas. Anybody know?
I'm sorry, I missed that.
He was the voice. He was the voice of the bad guy, of course. He was the Sauron of the piece.
Nice. Hmm. Nice. So I also just have a ton of writer friends and writers who I admire who are LGBT, and was really excited at the opportunity to get us all together in one room and eat candy and read really good fiction. So, for example, Delia Sherman, who was my Clarion instructor, and her wife, Ellen Kushner, are going to be reading. And one of my Clarion classmates, Carmen Machado, is coming. And it's going to be a great lineup.
I don't know her.
She's phenomenal. She actually had a story accepted at Clarion. She had her third week Clarion story accepted in the fourth week of Clarion. And we were all cheering and shaking our fists under the table with jealousy.
Is she at this moment unpublished?
She's had a ton of short stories published in different places.
Has.
And she has the story that was accepted is coming out in Strange Horizons very shortly.
Okay, well, you need to tell her that a
rising
there's a radio
star.
Show. That likes to have people like that.
I definitely will.
On the radio. I firmly believe that science fiction fantasy, here's another thing in which it doesn't have a name. You know, it's really neither Ellen nor Delia write science fiction, do they? They write fantasy, but we call it SF. So we make up for that by using speculative fiction, which is ironically a term coined by Robert Heinlein, who's not exactly the fuzziest, friendliest, you know, when it comes to openness about different gender possibilities that one could think of. But he created people don't know that he created the phrase speculative fiction.
Interesting.
But I definitely think of, he used it. He wrote Starship Troopers, and it's on like page 160 out of 180 that all of a sudden people realize that this book, which is told in the first person, is being told by a Puerto Rican. Hmm. And that was a breakthrough, that all of a sudden people were making their assumptions about Heinlein characters and all that, and all of a sudden, bang. he hit you in the face with that, and I admired him for that. There was a time when I could admire Heinlein for a couple of things. You two are a writer, Sam.
Yes, I am a writer.
Oh, of course, Buzz. Clarion.
Yes, and I edited an anthology called Horror After 9/11 of essays about the horror film since the events of September 11th, which was published by University of Texas Press last year, and is a delightful, if somewhat academic, stroll through the genre.
Yeah, although I will maintain, I hope I'm not offending anybody here, that the best post 9/11 fantasy story, maybe story period bar none, is There's a Hole in the City, written by Richard Bowes.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny you should mention Rick Bowes, because he too will be reading on January 7th at Blue Stockings Books with myself and Delia and Ellen and some candy.
So who's tell us the entire lineup. You keep coming up with these people out of the woodwork.
The entire lineup is Carmen Maria Machado, Val Howlett, Delia Sherman, Ellen Kushner, Rick Bowes, and myself.
Very good. Very good. How long is that going to be?
See, this is where...
That's the issue.
This is where curation is going to be essential, because with six readers, time is definitely of the essence, which is why the story I may be previewing tonight is extremely short. My general philosophy, I've done a lot of readings, and my general philosophy is people like the shortest reader the best.
Because I'm 5'4". Never mind.
The person who reads the briefest story creates the least demand on the audience's attention, and therefore they are predisposed to be sympathetic towards them. So my mandate whenever I'm reading is to be the shortest reader. So the story that I'm reading tonight will be short, and I'm encouraging my curatees on January 7th to read something short.
Curatees. That's a new one on me. Yeah. It makes perfect sense. If you have a curator, you have interviewer, interviewee, responder, respondent, curatee, absolutely.
I'm learning new words.
Yeah.
We're making new words.
Okay. Yeah, well, that's
it's gonna be that. It's going to be that kind of 90 minutes.
English is dynamic.
Yeah, I guess it is.
Jen, after the bookstore. Okay, well, first of all, you've started, I would say, of all the reading series, and yours is an ongoing, not a one-off.
Hopefully, yes.
If we have anything to say about it. Mm-hmm. Your reading series, I think, first of all, trumps all others for the best name of a reading series.
I would second that emotion.
In New York.
Cool. I'm glad to hear that.
And that is Kindred.
The Kindred Reading
and
Series.
And for those who don't know, shame on you. No. For those who don't know, you have a delight waiting. First of all, Kindred... To me, the name, the word, is a warm, welcoming word, despite the story from... But even there, the story from which it comes is warm and welcoming and
soft and fuzzy.
I like
the title because it has so many different meanings.
Yeah.
And you can think of the Octavia Butler story, but it also depicts how much of a... We're trying to kind of build a little bit of a community amongst... These writers that
and
are...
And these people are kindred.
And we are kindred.
They're kindred spirits.
And we want to not just be one particular color, but all colors.
Uh-huh.
And all of us kind of expressing our own words, our own stories. And it's been a lot of fun so far. We've had about, I think, 3 readings this year. I got to read the first one. Which was a little unplanned, by the way, but that's what happened.
And but I liked it.
I had a good
time. Although it was I know it's a space you're not going to reuse, but I liked the folksy outdoors feeling. I disliked the traffic about 5 feet from me.
Yeah, unfortunately, I didn't think of that when I scheduled the reading.
But it was wonderful to attend. It had a great feeling to it.
It was a neat idea that didn't. Quite work out, but I read
it. Was worth the doing, and
it was.
And as far as I'm concerned, it was worth the attending.
Yeah.
I had a great time.
Oh, good. I did too. Once I got past the nerves, because it was the first one.
You know.
Yeah, and but I read with Kini.
Yeah, Kini Ibiru Salam, who is going to eventually get on this show.
She better.
If
you're listening.
Yeah, but I promised. To get her on, like, at that reading was, like, June?
Oh, that's quite some time ago.
Yeah, and it hasn't happened yet, but nonstop fundraising drives and various interruptions, and boy, did I have a summer full of interruptions. Tony, there's some cheese and crackers over there.
Thank you.
He says walking out without going near it. Oh, be that way. That? Be that way. Walks out holding a candy bar. Some people's engineers. Anyway. Well, he's not an engineer. He's the ops guy. But anyway. Yeah. Tony Ryan, ladies and gentlemen. Anyway. It had a great feeling. So at this point, it's not necessary. Well, to say something is strictly POC, white is POC, is a color too. But, yeah. But we're not going there yet.
Not yet, because there are just too many people of color who haven't really gotten an introduction out there yet. I mean, so many of us are kind of newish writers,
mm-hmm.
You know, just getting a book out or you know, almost there, have some stories out, new in their career in some ways. And so to give them a chance to kind of be out there. But we also do have some award-winning authors that have been out there for quite some time, like Linda Addison, who just read with us.
I'm sorry I missed that.
That was She's a great reading. We read at Singularity Bookstore, and they were great. They were really great. To us.
How is the ambience, he asked, as a person who records events?
Oh, actually, I think you could do a lot of good recordings in there because it was off, it's inside, it's off the, you know.
I've always steered clear of bookstores because people.
The noise.
The noise, yeah. People
Can I get a latte?
Yeah. Oh, well, Blue Stockings?
Yeah, that's going to happen.
Blue Stockings is... I have done a number of recordings at Blue Stockings. And then somebody orders either a latte or even worse. The worst thing is a cappuccino just... you know, in the middle of, Nora Jemison reading something really intimate and close and all of a sudden in the middle of the story. It's like,
where are your books on sex?
Yeah.
Feminism.
Well, all
or
over.
Gender studies or whatever.
Yeah. Blue Stockings is basically, by the way, a radical bookstore. Yeah. It's like if it's radical, it's in there.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what kind of radical. It's that. Yeah. That's the premise. Well located.
Yeah. We had a reading there as well. We had Tempest, K. Tempest Bradford, and E.B. Zogby. So,
now, you see, there's a person I don't know.
You don't know E.B.? Oh, my goodness.
Or do I?
I have to believe you know her in some way.
Yeah.
She was in Dark Matter, Sheree Thomas's, the second book.
Oh, okay.
And
Rolling the Bones? Is that
the name of the second? You're catch
Dark
me.
Matter 2.
Dark Matter 2. You're going to catch me on that one.
Yeah.
And she's been in quite a few others. I believe
Sheree,
she went
back
to Clarion as well. And I can't remember the year. Forgive me. Edie.
I've done the show for now. January will be 41 years. Mm. Twice we've had people who weren't at Clarion. It's like Or you're a third?
I didn't go to Clarion. I went to Stone Coast.
Oh, cool.
Yes. I graduated last year. Great program. My mentors were some of the most phenomenal people I ever got to work with. James Patrick Kelly was my first mentor. Then David Anthony Durham.
Both these are people that really, and what's very interesting about what you're both talking about is where, and most of the readers you have, including Rick Bowes, every one of these people are masters of the short form.
Yes.
These are not necessarily novelists.
Yes.
With Nora Jemison.
David kind of is. David is a novelist.
They can write novels, some of them. Rick has five.
Oh, that's true.
Okay. Nora has five. Mm-hmm. And Kate Jemison has a trilogy and a duology.
Yes.
But the short stories are what I dote on.
Yes.
And I like it when reading series, this is a personal preference, where somebody comes up and tells you a whole story.
I I agree with that. I really get a little annoyed with the excerpt from the novel and the other incomplete piece that leaves me wanting more, which can be can be nice.
It depends on how you do it.
Exactly.
Because if that leaves you more, makes you say, I want to get that thing, that could, you know, if you kind of leave you unsatisfied, then that's a problem.
Got it.
But if you left satisfied and I want more, and that can be very cool, but you really have to plan that.
Yeah, I mean, Jeff Ford will get up and read This Is What I Did Today.
Yeah.
And there is, he does that kind of thing. KGB does a lot of that. Yeah. But you see, I typify KGB. I don't know how much Matt and Ellen, who run it, agree with me about this, but as audience, not as a producer, not as a radio producer who likes to record as much as I can, I consider KGB to be a bit of a salon. Mm-hmm. It's a place where everybody goes almost, you can take a look at the room and pretty much almost name everybody in that room. Oh, there's this writer, there's that editor, there's this person. And under those circumstances, it's more appropriate to get that segment of, this is coming out next month, or like that. Now, of course, I allow my readers writer's choice. So, you know, if Delia Sherman says, I'm going to do a chapter from The Freedom Maze, I'm not going to say no. But what I will ask is that they try to find some self-contained continuity so that when people are done, they get a certain denouement of some kind. And the last thing in the world people should do, it's only happened to me once, one of my readers, is that somebody reads and looks at and says, oh, well, my time's about up, so if you want to find out what happens, you're going to have to buy the book. That person will find me gnawing their leg. It's, you know, and not in a friendly way.
I understand.
Why don't we perhaps take a quick break and then get on to a short reading, and then shortly after that, a longer reading.
Okay.
Okay. So, yeah, I say that, and of course, I don't have any music queued up, but hey, when have I ever been on top of... here's a song given to me by Ellen Kushner, so much the better. This is from a band called Piawakit.
Hey, we to the other world, boys, where 'tis thought they very merry be. There the man in the moon drinks claret to health, to thee, to me. Hey, we to the other world, boys, where 'tis thought they very merry be.
Hey, we to the other world, boys, where
'tis thought
they very merry be.
There the man in the moon drinks claret to health, to thee, to me.
Hey, we to the other world, boys.
Let's go.
Hey, Weed to the Other World from a band from, I think, the 80s called Piowacket. They only put out one album, and I had never heard of it, and I love it. But last time Ellen Datlow was here as herself, as opposed to as the producer of a radio drama or something like that, mm-hmm. she brought me that album, and I am so grateful. And speaking of being grateful, this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. My name is Jim Freund. Besides being the purveyor of this show, I produce the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, which I also curate. We have with us Sam Miller, who is producing a one-off of queer science fiction writers, a word that catches in my throat because I am of an older age when that was nothing but a pejorative.
I appreciate that you're stepping outside your comfort zone by using it.
Yeah, no, I really am. Every time I say it, it's like, it really, really, it's just because...
The only alternative is that acronym that you that also makes you roll your eyes.
How about nice person? I don't know. To me, queer comes from, like, you know, he lives in a queer house where weird things happen. It means there's a ghost in there. It's, I don't know. It's just a, but also, it's really from my ute. I grew up in a part of Queens when people would say, hey, let's go out and roll some queers. They were not going to be treating the people they were referring to well.
Right.
It was a violent word, a nasty, nasty word, which to me, you know, we have the list of words that you cannot say. And to me, in my comfort zone, as you put it, that's one of them. And it's just, you know, and yeah, I hear people were, you know, reclaiming the word for our own and all that. But I don't know. Words have power and meaning and all that. And given the era in which I grew up and the people that abused the word and abused the people for whom they assigned the word, it's difficult to reassign it semantically. That's a good way to put it, semantically.
That makes sense. Yeah.
But I refuse to. I can't even remember BLTLG, whatever, you know. So I'll go with queer.
Okay. It's a wild adventure we're on here.
Sam, you have a short.
I do. I have a very short story that I will read with the audience's permission. This story is called Kenneth, a User's Manual. Congratulations on your purchase of Kenneth Barrow, summer 1981's most desirable creature. 6 foot nothing in combat boots and a sweat damp t-shirt, immaculately scruffed, conquistador of dance floors, both foreign and domestic. Foreign meaning north of 42nd Street. Our genuine Kenneth is reconstructed from his prime, using details extracted from the minds of over 60 aging queens who beheld his beauty at its zenith, in that great glorious twilight of our age, who between them encompass every aspect of his perfection. Virtual Kenneth is not a toy. None of our other virtual boys have seen such a high volume of use-related suicide. Following these simple instructions will ensure that you get the most from your boy, with minimal risk of strained muscles, sore knees, ravaged sphincters, broken hearts. Item 1. Your Kenneth will be cruel. No attempt was made to varnish or mitigate his vanity, his arrogance, his confidence that you would do absolutely anything for the pleasure of his physical proximity. Plenty of virtual boys line digital shelves, Frankensteined together to degrees of pornographic perfection, the bluest of eyes, the hugest of hard-ons, the pecs and nipples and musical tastes most precisely calibrated to get you where you get off. These boys project pure desire, smiling hugely at the advances of the obese and the old alike. These boys will be overjoyed to do whatever you want. Not so with Kenneth. His notorious fickleness has been preserved inviolate. His positive or negative response to your attempts to dance with him or drag him into the back room depends on 100 complex algorithmic approximations that not even we fully understand. This was a huge point of contention between we, the creators, and the manufacturers. Item 2. Do not attempt to introduce your Kenneth to any simulations of actual sunlight. Every single scrap of Kenneth memory we could find features him lit by strobing spotlights or the star stream of mirror ball specks. Bringing him to a virtual beach or a Central Park picnic may result in a vertigo or epilepsy-inducing light refraction pattern. Item 3. Long-term use is not recommended. Our initial efforts to program in an expiration date were scotched by the manufacturer, who felt it would hurt sales. Item 4. Do not attempt to scratch the surface of Kenneth. No last name, no idyllic childhood, no fondness for opera or sweet potato pie lurks beneath his radiant skin. Exhaustive research has indeed yielded his last name, but that is all we have, and we will keep it for ourselves, we, the creators, who cling to that privilege as we cling to the use of the royal we as a euphemism for one sad man chasing glimpses of a long-dead boy in a long-dead world. Or the manufacturer as a gentler way of saying greedy pockmarked capitalist who doesn't care who he hurts. Item 5. Never forget that Kenneth is a fossil, last exemplar of a vanished species. There are no Kenneth sightings after 1984. He did not move to San Francisco or Madrid. We have scanned the memory logs of millions searching for Kenneth. If Kenneth was alive, he would have found a dance floor. Item 6. Those of you who did not live through the plague years and have purchased Kenneth as part of the AIDS history teaching module may be surprised to find it part of the curriculum surrounding a vanished disease. But Kenneth is vital. Kenneth is why the disease did what it did. Kenneth is why so many people made fatal decisions. Dancing beside Kenneth, smelling him, watching sweat swirl off his head when he spins, you will know why someone would risk death for 1 hour underneath him. Item 7. You grow old. Kenneth does not. Your body breaks down slowly, betraying you piece by piece, and every new calamity that does not kill you adds another name to the long list of pills you must pop every day. For this reason, the red wine head rush joy you get from Kenneth will sour into vinegar over time.
Oh, you know, Mr. Blake, I'm gonna like you an awful lot, 'cause you're my weakness now. In this age of machinery, you walk in a beanery, you drop a nickel in the slot and get a bowl of pepper pot. That's how you dine today. There's the airplane and radio and the talking picture show. Everything's electrified, mechanically we fly and ride. We'll soon make love that way. I want a mechanical man, a super dynamic old man. Say if he picks on me and he gives me a fuse, if he doesn't stop, I'll just turn off the news. My friend, we are fun. He'll do what I want him to do. Say if he doesn't love me in a great big way, I'll have his battery charged and then he'll be okay. I think it's a marvelous plan, don't you, to have a mechanical man. I want a mechanical man, a 200 type of a man. Each evening at 10, I'll turn down the lights, I'll switch on the dial and he'll kiss me goodnight. I'll teach him to cook and to sweep, and I'll get him to tuck me to sleep. If he gets run down and can't give me a thrill, I'll go and train him right in for someone else who will. I'll train him right in for a man who can, a brand new mechanical man.
Oh, you little rat.
Come on, Dollar, let's go.
Okay, thank you, Winnie Leitner, from the Gold Diggers of Broadway, 1929 Warner Brothers. But more importantly, and certainly more currently, no pun intended with the word currently, what was his name?
Kenneth, A User's Manual.
Kenneth, A User's Manual. It's a lovely title and premise. I like that.
Thank you. Thank you. That is approximately 75% of the story. I did what I just said I hate, which is when someone reads an incomplete portion of a story so as to entice folks to come out on January 7th and hear the rest of the story. Precisely. Where they will not only hear wonderful readers read and hear the end of that story, they will also get candy.
No, okay, but you see, I feel like my listeners have just been cheated. I've got listeners all over the world. We got phone calls from a fan, Bobson, in Bulgaria. He's not going to show, I promise you. So it's like, oh, come on. But, well, we'll get you to record.
It was all downhill from there. Bulgaria's not missing anything.
Well, what about Oz? You see, with the advent of the internet.
Got it.
We're not just New York.
That's true. It's true. We are posterity.
We are. Speak for yourself. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial, Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. The program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. This is a weekly program of science fiction, fantasy, and related fields of endeavor. If you are not listening to us live, you can be listening to us at archive.wbai.org or just go to my website, ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF, and wherever Pacifica has hidden the archives of my show, which are currently only there for 2 weeks, although we're trying to extend that. It should be about 13 weeks, but because I play music. Anyway, Pacifica politics. Anyway. You can go to my website and find out what shows are extant there.
Great.
And if you can't find it, ask me. Send me an email, jim@ourwolf.com. It's HOURWOLF. Jen.
Yes.
First do me a favor and pull that mic closer to you.
Okay.
That's fine.
That's good?
That's very good.
Okay.
And the Kindred Readings, when is the next?
The next one will be in February. It will be at Word Bookstore. We will be having...
they have a lovely space downstairs.
It's a great space, actually. I saw Jeffrey Ford read there.
Oh, really?
Yes, and it was really a lot of fun. Great space.
Another of my clarion instructors. I'm not bragging.
It's worth bragging. For those people who don't know Jeffrey Ford.
Amazing writer.
A genius.
Wonderful writer. Absolute genius. Son of a SOB moved to Ohio just to avoid coming on the show on a regular basis. I'm very annoyed at him. Oh, well, there's a lot of good writers in Ohio. Yeah. Chris Barzak.
Oh, I didn't know he was in Ohio.
Yeah.
Oh,
okay. Yeah, Columbus.
Yes. So we're going to be having N.K. Jemisin and Daniel Jose Older.
Anybody good?
I know, really. I'm really slacking there.
Yeah.
We limit our readings to about two.
He's got an event coming up in January
sometime.
Yeah, January 15th, yes. I think. Before it happens, I'll get all of the information. Mm-hmm. And let me just tell people, when Daniel reads, he's not just reading. It's a complete multimedia thing. And I read his stories. I knew his stories. And I loved his stories for themselves. And then I saw him perform.
Yeah.
With the band behind him.
And it really worked.
Oh, better than work.
It really, really did.
It added a whole other dimension of performance art to those stories. And we are. Whether we are here at 120 Wall Street or elsewhere, we are going to record studio versions.
That needs to happen.
That really needs to happen. And if I ever take this show to a podcast, which I want to do, I can't use licensed music unless the composer gives me the rights.
Yeah.
Hey there, Daniel. How are you doing? So anyway, so he and I are going to do that as well.
Yeah, so that should be a great reading in February, please.
And we didn't even mention, what was that other person?
That slouch. Yeah, N.K. Jemisin.
She hasn't been on too much recently because her day job.
Well, she's got a lot going on. Nora's got a lot going on.
She's where the heck did she come from? What is it now, 3 to 4 years? And she has 5 novels, however many Nebula nominations.
Yeah, she's been
all
really cooking.
Of this so well deserved and so brilliant.
Yeah.
Where is Word Bookstore?
Word Bookstore is in Greenpoint, I believe.
And here I can look it up here. It's a spiffy place. Yeah. It's also a nice bookstore.
Yeah. I believe the G-Line will get you there.
Yeah, it's about the only thing that'll get
you
there. Yeah. The G-Line.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, it's gotten much better recently, I think. Great bookstore, and should be a great reading.
Great.
I look forward to
it. What's the date on it?
You're going to catch me on that. It's in February. Please go to our website, kindredreadingseries.org, and you'll find all the links and such for us.
And also for you and for me, for both those reading series. And I don't know, Sam, if you've done this yet, but I find it useful. Facebook events.
Yes.
Facebook groups.
I use that.
Yeah.
So I
find it doesn't necessarily bring in new people, but it reminds them.
Yes.
And it makes sure that they are, in fact, going to show up, and it's worth doing.
If you go to our website, it'll link off to our Facebook page and also our Twitter, so that you can get nice reminders of all of our events that way, plus pictures and other kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
Links to stories sometimes links to neat short films. I like to post those.
Mm. Okay, who's been filming? I tried to film your first one, but I was too experimental with my equipment.
Oh, nobody's been filming.
Oh, we'll fix it.
I've just been taking lots of pictures to try to record that the events did in fact happen, and we've had some really great readings, and I hope to continue to have a lot more going into next year. I look forward to next year.
Yeah. I'm going to announce my reading, and then you, Jen, are going to read. Are you recording your event at all?
I'm thinking about it.
Yeah.
Thinking about it.
Yeah. Although I'm busy the next day because my event is the next day.
Oh, of course.
but maybe what I can do is loan you my equipment or something.
We'll chat. That's great.
We'll,
that'd be
we'll
great.
Chat. Thank you. And work that out. My next reading, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, I've got a fabulous duo, not of stars, but of great, great writers. And they are Terry McGarry and Veronica Shanus. And Terry, who hasn't published any novel stuff in a while, she has a trilogy that came out some years ago, the Illumination Trilogy from Tor. And I Alien, all this stuff. She was at the New Yorker for 15 years. She was chief copy editor. Yeah. Now, can you imagine the New Yorker, you know, being the person who does the corrections? New Yorker and the New York Times were once upon a time the place where it's like, you know, is this correct? Well, if you don't have an OED or the style manual about, you could count on the New Yorker. That's Terry McGarry. And aside from that, she's just a wonderful person and a really, really, really good fantasy writer. And Celtic musician and third, I'm looking at her bio, third level belt in Krav Maga. Do not anger this woman.
Do not.
Okay.
Do not anger this woman. No. Veronica Shanus and Veronica was only on this show... was on the show only 3 weeks ago, along with Genevieve Valentine. And the two of them, oh my God, did we geek out? Did they geek out? It's a wonderful show. Veronica is an assistant professor at the Department of English at Queen's College, where she specializes teaching. She gets paid to teach speculative fiction and children's literature.
Yeah.
Some people are
nice
just,
work if you can get it.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, I know.
She has a forthcoming story in Ellen Datlow and Terry Windling's Queen Victoria's Book of Spells. As an academic, Professor Shanus is particularly interested in children's literature, women's writing, and fantastic literature. Publications include topics such as Fearless Children and Fabulous Monsters, Lewis Carroll, Angela Carter, and The Beastly Girls. I mean, you know, this is serious stuff. Book as Mirror, Mirror's Book, and the Significance of the Looking Glass in Contemporary Revisions of Fairy Tales.
Hmm.
I mean, this is cool stuff. So that's on January 8th. The one at Blue Stockings is Monday, January 7th.
Correct.
Mine is Tuesday, January 8th, and mine is at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art at 138 Sullivan Street. And again, for more information, go to my website, ourwolf.com, or check it out on Facebook. Look for New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, or failing that, just the acronym NYRSF NYRSF. And you can learn more there. But Jen, you are also, of course, a writer.
Yes, I am.
And you have a story for us.
I do. I brought a story that I don't know if you know about. Let's see. I could just begin.
Why not? Is there any talking up to be done? And do you need any water? Even while you read, I can...
I have some water, I hope you enjoy this. I hope this doesn't bring the spirit down, but I'm going to begin.
Bringing the spirit down at WVAI is not a possible task.
Okay. Here we go. It's called The Executioner. The day of the execution was the first and only time I'd ever been to a prison. It was a lot bigger than I expected it to be. There was more light in it, too. I thought it would be a dark place with screaming inmates yelling at me as I passed through. But that's not how it was at all. Everyone was silent when they saw me. I was like Moses parting the Red Sea, only the sea was people moving out of my way. There were guards on every side of me as I walked through the prison. They guided my way to the death house in the backyard. I was death personified that day, and everyone knew it. I felt kind of powerful. I looked up and saw these big, tough men who were afraid of me. That's what I was that day, death personified. I was warned not to look anyone in the eye that didn't work for the state, so I kept my head down. It was hard not to look up, feeling the heat of so many stares on me. But I did as I was told. I was a good citizen. This was what the state required. My name had come up, and that's what happens. You do your duty. That's how my family raised me. You don't shy away from your responsibilities. You stand up and do what needs to be done. I took no joy in being there. I knew that this was nothing to be happy about either. This was just something that had to be done, and my name had come up, and that's all there was to it. They marched me to the back, where there was a large green lawn. Inmates were working to cut the grass, and they, too, stopped to stare at me as I passed by. The sky was unusually bright that day. It was clear and blue as far as the eyes could see, and it was so quiet, like the birds themselves knew that it was a solemn day. I had just had my second child a few months before. I would have rather been home with her. She was such a little thing and a really good baby. I could hand her to anyone and she wouldn't cry. She'd just look up at them and with wonder and lean into their chests, calm and pleasant. I felt so lucky to have a good home and family. It was the state that kept us all safe from the likes of the one that I was going to put down. The way I look at it, this was a little to ask of a citizen whom the state had given so much. The death house looked like an old chapel with a small A-roof and peeling window wallpaper made to resemble stained glass. Inside was quiet and people spoke in hushed tones. There were prison guards everywhere. They, like the prisoners, stilled when they saw me. The warden was there to greet me. He was friendly enough, businesslike though. He shook my hand and escorted me to the lunchroom, where a fine meal was waiting for me. The state sent a packet to my house with the return form requesting that I list the meal that I would like to be served. I must admit that they got everything just right. Funny, I could remember enjoying the meal, but I don't remember the meal itself. It's like I have a memory of a memory of it. While I sat and ate, the warden and the prison guard watched. It felt strange to be the only one chewing. The warden told me to eat up since I wouldn't be able to have anything again until the next day. That's the way the drugs worked. If you tried to eat right after taking them, they could really make you feel sick to your stomach. When I was done, the warden and I had coffee together. This time the guards joined in with us. I felt like I had become part of a ritual of theirs. I wondered how many of these executions they had attended. I wanted to ask, but didn't. We all just sat quietly together, sipping our coffee until it was gone or got cold. The warden took off his glasses and rubbed his eyes. For a moment, I thought he was crying. When he looked up, I saw that he wasn't. He just looked tired. He put his glasses back on and laid his palms out flat on the table. "Did you read the packet that the state sent?" the warden asked. "Yes," I nodded. "Good. Well, I'm going to briefly go over the basics again of what is going to happen tonight. Please stop me at any time if there is something you don't understand or if you have a question." I nodded again. "We will take a little bit of your blood now. It will be used to create a drug cocktail. It will be prepared and injected into you in about an hour. Once you receive the injection, you are the state's agent of execution. The drug will only affect the condemned. It is coated with his DNA and yours. You cannot harm any other person with your touch. Do you understand?" I nodded. "You have to answer verbally. It's the law." I said yes. The warden continued, "We will wait until midnight for any last-minute reprieves. If there are none, you'll be escorted to the death chamber by these guards to face the condemned. Myself and the minister for the condemned will be in the room. A family member and a witness for the condemned may also be in the death chamber. He will be strapped down securely onto a gurney. You will be perfectly safe." I instinctively looked at the guard sitting with us. One of them lowered his head to avoid my eyes. "He will be allowed to say his last words," the warden said. "Will he say anything to me?" "The law states that the prisoner has the right to face his executioner. He may say something to you." The warden took off his glasses again and spoke softly. "My advice is to pay no attention to what he says. He doesn't know you and you don't know him. Remember, you are not his judge or his jury. You didn't determine his guilt or innocence. Others perform that function. You are his executioner. You are just performing your lawful civic duty." I must admit that I had always just assumed that the man was guilty. I didn't know what he was condemned for doing. The packet from the state suggested that I not research the case, so I didn't. Sometimes I think that was a mistake. "When you are ready, you are to physically touch the condemned." "How am I supposed to touch him?" I asked. "Any way you see fit," the warden said. "I've known some who hugged them and others who just put a pinky finger on them. There is no right or wrong way, as long as there is physical contact." "And that's all that takes? It takes?" "Yes, ma'am. Death will commence at that point." "How long will it take?" It felt ghoulish asking, but I really wanted to know. "Death may occur within a few moments. You are legally required to remain with the condemned until he is dead. Then you are free to go." The night passed slowly. The lab technician who had mixed the drug cocktail was also the one to administer my injection. He made me roll up my sleeve and rub my arm with cool alcohol. "This may sting," he warned. It did. "You may get a slight fever tomorrow," he said. "It will pass. You'll be fine in a day or two." I unrolled my sleeve as he put his needles and things away. The area where I was injected felt sore and began to throb. My arm ached for several days after that. Such a small price to pay. "At least you won't ever be asked to do this again. The drug only works once. It will never work in you again. At least that's something." "At least that's something," I repeated. I spent the rest of the afternoon in the lunchroom with the guards. They were good people. We talked about our families and showed each other pictures of our kids. We played cards and dominoes to while away the time. I couldn't help constantly looking up at the clock. It seemed to be ticking slower than usual. I began to feel anxious as the sun came down. I had survived the weeks preceding that night by simply not thinking about ending a man's life. After the sun came down, all that changed. What I was about to do was all I could think about. I was just a small-town mother of two. How had I become this agent of death? By 9 p.m., I was visibly shivering. "I don't feel well," I said to the guards. "I want to go home." They just looked down. One of them said to me, "You're just nervous. This happens to everyone." "But I feel sick to my stomach," I said. It was no lie. My stomach was twisted into knots upon knots. I felt like I could throw up. "That's normal," he said. "It feels like that every single time I have to do one of these." By 11 p.m., the guards and I were all on our feet. The cordial feeling between us was gone. Now it was all business. The minutes passed like hours. Then it was finally time. The guards escorted me to the death chamber. My legs were moving on their own because I felt nothing. We entered the room, and it was like the warden said it would be. He was there standing next to the minister. And there was the condemned man. He was on a gurney strapped down by large belts. His arms were stretched out in two protruding extensions of the gurney so that he looked like a man on the cross. He was just a boy, really. Maybe he was in his late 20s. There was something about his expression that reminded me of my little brother. He physically looked nothing like my brother, but the way he held his face and moved his head was just like him. I heard a whimpering as if it were coming from an injured animal. There were two women standing behind a glass window. They were holding each other. One looked elderly. The other was young. "Do you have any last words?" the warden asked. The boy craned his neck to see the two women through the window. "I love you," he said. "I'm sorry, Mama." I felt my knees begin to shake. I didn't want to be there. I didn't want to be there. I did not want to be there. The boy looked back at me. He had soft brown eyes. He was not what I expected at all. The warden nodded to me that it was time. My legs went completely numb. I couldn't move. I could hardly catch my breath. My feet were like wet cement melting into the floor. "When you are ready," the warden said. Many moments went by, and I still didn't move. I stared at the boy. My heart pounded in my chest. No one said anything. It was deathly silent. It was all up to me, and I couldn't move. The warden waited patiently. Then he looked at his watch. I saw him wave his hand to the guards. And these men, these good men who I had spent the whole day with and shared pictures of my kids, grabbed me and forced me forward. It was then that I understood that the guards were not there just to protect me, but to force me if I tried to refuse. I fought them. I fought them hard. I waved my arms and scratched like a cat. A wild animal arrived in me that I never knew was there. "Don't touch me," I screamed, and they backed away. The women behind the glass looked at me with a kind of hope and sympathy. I felt a flush of guilt and shame. I felt naked before them. I straightened out my clothes and passed my hands over my hair. Then I slowly stepped towards the boy. He looked at me with eyes that tore into my soul. I went over to him. I said, "I'm sorry." He nodded and swallowed. I took his hand in mine. It was soft and warm. Then I backed away. Minutes passed and nothing happened. I felt a wave of relief. I had read in the packet sent to my house that sometimes the drugs don't take. I felt a joy, and then I didn't. And I felt a joy that I didn't think could be possible. The boy smiled at me. He looked over at his mother. She weakly waved back at him. My face was completely wet at this point. I wiped away my tears. Then the boy jerked. He convulsed for a few moments, twisting in his restraints. Little pockets of foam appeared at the corner of his mouth. His eyes turned back so that they were all white. His body shook for a moment. Then he let out a deep sigh and closed his eyes. Then he moaned a little, as if he were having a troubled dream. I could see his chest still moving. Then he jerked again, and he moved no more. The warden came over and checked his pulse. Death occurred, he said, and looked at his watch, at 12:27 a.m. I can't explain the feeling I had then. It's a feeling that has never left me. I felt hollowed out like a Halloween pumpkin, all carved out with nothing left inside. I had killed a man. With my own hand, I killed him. I looked at his body, and it was like there was nothing else. I couldn't hear anything. I couldn't feel anything. The guards unstrapped him, and his body, his slack body, flopped. I looked away. I heard someone let out a loud cry. I thought it was the boy's mother. I was surprised to find that it was me. I could barely walk. The guards helped me out of the building and escorted me to the parking lot. Someone called to me. I turned around and it was the boy's mother. Her daughter was trying to hold her back. She was coming at me. The guard stood in her way. "I want to speak to you," she said. I said, "It's all right." Inside, I felt even if she wanted to hit me, it was all right. The guards got out of the way and the daughter hesitantly let the old woman go. She was short, so that I had to look down to see her. She looked up at me. My legs buckled, and I found myself on my knees before her. She took my hand, the hand that had just killed her son, and she held it in hers. Her small, veiny hands cradled mine. "This was not your fault," she said. "I will pray for you and your family." Then she let my hand go and turned towards her daughter. They held each other and slowly walked into the night. My husband once told me that all the cells in my body completely change every 7 years. Well, it's been 7 years since then, and I still feel the same. There's not a day that goes by that I don't think about it. I don't talk about it with anyone. My husband knows just to leave it alone. I know I've been different, more quiet. I think about things more. I think about life more. It's a warm day today. The sky is blue as far as the eyes can see. My eldest is playing in the yard with his little sister. I've been watching them laughing and tumbling around in the grass. They are so innocent. Their whole lives are in front of them, their eyes filled with only possibilities. His mama must have had days like this, days when she looked out at her children, laughing and playing, and dreamed of what they could be.
You've been listening to The Executioner, read for you by the author Jen Brissett here over WBAI in New York. Whenever an author reads a story on the air, I try to find a piece of music that can match that. And there's virtually, you know, nothing except maybe, I don't know, some like Adagio in String by Samuel Barber, you know, something. There's nothing blithe. Yeah. That.
Sorry about that.
Oh, stop that. That was a great story and a great reading.
It was a great story and a great reading.
Thank you.
And it did what stories should do, which is make us feel things. So nothing wrong with making us feel things.
Yeah, and it was new. I mean, they say there's only five plots in science fiction. Now there are six. That one, it reminded me a tiny bit, and not as being similar, but as being a pairing with a story by Terry Bisson called Max, which is a nasty little piece of work in which these Macs are being killed one by one of the victims. And turns out the Macs are clones of Timothy McVeigh. And every victim of Timothy McVeigh.
Oh, I've heard of this story. I've not read it, but I've heard of it.
Yeah. It's funny. Well, you know, catch in your throat.
Oh.
Satirical. Not funny, but satirical.
Uh-huh.
Dark, 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 dark comedy. So, you know, in that sense, there's also a more serious J.G. Ballard executioner story, but it's nothing.
It made me think of The Lottery by Shirley Jackson. And that, I mean, that's a satire. That's a, that's sort of like a dark parody that isn't really like, it's going for a different, it's going for the jugular as opposed to this, which I think really goes for the gut and goes for like, you know, like making you actually feel things about these characters. So
and for the
it's
heart.
Doing its own.
Yeah,
it's doing its own.
That was a wrenching little piece there, Jen. That, I like that.
Oh, no.
Have a cracker.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was somewhat inspired by Jose Padilla. I believe that's how you pronounce his name.
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah. One morning, I was watching Death at the something at the Death House Doors, IFC documentary on the Reverend who actually has seen all, it must be like 90 or so deaths, mm-hmm. Executions. He helped them all through it. He was their friend in the end. And this one particular prisoner is pretty much been determined at this point was innocent. And he was executed about, maybe 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a young man. And he had his whole life in front of him. And it looked like somebody else had done the crime. And it's a pretty sad thing to think that this has been happening. And the story sort of popped in my head. And I wrote it one night.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Wow. Well, a powerful story, clever story, Sam. Both of you, good stuff. And you're going to follow that, eh, Lister? Good luck. Burn Baby Burn Clappers is coming your way in just a few minutes. We have about 6 minutes left. Time flies, right?
Yep,
it's true.
But if people wish to call up and be on topic, you are invited to do so by calling us at 917-580-6020. Yes, here we still in this building do not have phone lines. That's why the number to call in is a 917 area code. Our engineers and ops department have created some way, I think using either Skype or Google Voice or something like that, to enable us to take calls. So again, it's 917-580-6020. Guys, you're going to have to put on headphones for this portion of the proceedings. And again, I will, listeners, if you are not on topic, I will be making short shrift of your call. Good morning. You are on the radio. Hello. Hi.
How do you know I couldn't stop crying? It was so upsetting, that story. I don't know how that woman could do that. I find the world so evil that I can't even put it into words. What she is talking about...
You say you, because you're talking to Jen Brissett, the author. So no need for...
I'm awed by her power of description. And then she mentioned Padilla, and I keep thinking of all the dreadful people that are murdered innocently and all the good people that are maligned and the evil people come out smiling.
Mm-hmm.
And you always do excellent programming, but I needed her to know that that's how upsetting and real it is to have innocent people die. And I don't think it's unusual. I think it's very common.
Yeah,
of course, your music is exceptional, so I always agree with everything you do with the music. And you always have intelligent people, but they don't do physically what he actually got me to do. Don't ask me how, but that's the kind of writing. It's hard to believe that humans could be so powerful.
I'm glad that you enjoyed it.
Wow.
Yeah, not even.
I will append to what you said. It's horrible even when the guilty are treated that way. I have a problem with capital punishment. Period.
Well, I definitely
do. Problem. I think it's so evil, but what can I tell you?
What?
You're a magnificent writer. I just wish more people could hear it. It might change the world.
I get really excited about the way that speculative fiction lets us look at problems in a new way, or to make them real in a different way. And what this story did so excellently was to explore how everyone is guilty and everyone is implicated in some way when you do live in a society that has things like capital punishment. And so I think that was a really fascinating speculative concept to sort of look at that.
Yeah, and it's both of your stories utterly showcase the power of speculative fiction. And before, given that Sam, you're producing a reading series of queer writers, a one-off,
right,
to start with, of queer writers, Jen, you have the ongoing Kindred reading series. And while mine is not themed for any particular group other than spec fic, I think it is all about the outsiders. I think one of the great tropes of science fiction is that people are writing from the alien viewpoint when it's good. Science fiction so often. This is what James Tiptree, one of my favorite writers, she was always capable of pulling off. And I was always convinced that she was a guy. because she had that viewpoint. She wrote as a man. To this day, I will say James Tiptree was a man who was inhabited by Alice B. Sheldon.
I'm sorry, she was one of us.
But she was one of us as well. She was a human.
Yes, she was.
And she wrote from a male point of view that I could appreciate.
Yeah.
And in some cases, not appreciate, depending on who her narrator was. But this is the power of speculative fiction, both in satire, such as Sam's story, and in...
I'm not even sure how to classify that particular story.
Up close and personal.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want...
It's an alien viewpoint story. Yeah. Let's take a step back and look at what we're really doing.
I was desperately trying not to write a story that was preachy. And was trying to tell, I mean, I obviously, of my own, have my own feelings about capital punishment, but I didn't want to have a story to tell people how to feel, but I wanted people to feel that, you know, there's a whole group of people that we don't even think about, which are the people who actually perform these executions and do it over and over and over and over. And we don't really even think about, well, this is their job, the guards, the warden, all the various people who are involved, and we pay them to kill people. And we sort of pretend that our hands are clean. And I wanted...
Oh, they play games with that, like in a firing squad, one person's gun isn't loaded, so that everybody can pretend they're not the one who
but
shot
it's all
that
pretense.
Person. Oh, yeah.
We're all involved.
Yeah. Listen, thank you so much for calling.
Thank you
for calling, and thank you for what you said.
Okay, have a good morning. We need, we have theoretically, about 25 seconds left, but what I'm going to do is start the outro music quietly underneath. But what I need each of you to do is to tell us when your next events will be, or simply how people can find out. So, Sam.
So the LGBTQ science fiction and fantasy.
Are those the train lines you can
that's right.
You take can, to get there?
All roads lead to queer. Reading will be on January 7th at Blue Stockings Books in Manhattan at 7 p.m., where you will hear myself, Carmen Maria Machado, Val Howlett, Rick Bowes, Delia Sherman, and Ellen Kushner be amazing, and there will be candy.
Okay, very good.
In case you didn't.
Got to get that candy.
Chronologically speaking, January 8th, the New York Review of Science Fiction readings. I'll be here. Will I have a show? Yes, I'll be here next week before that, so I'll have a chance to promote it. So I pass the torch.
My next event, the Kindred reading series, will be in February. Please check our website, which is kindredreadingseries.org. It has all the links to both our Twitter and Facebook page, and all of the information will be posted specifically on our Facebook page. So just go to our website and you can link to that.
And the next reader will be Daniel Jose Older
and N.K. Jemison.
And Nora Jemison.
Yes.
A great double feature. So thank you again, Jen Brisson and Sam Miller, for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
This was a great pleasure.
Well, likewise, and for everybody listening, I trust. Thank you all for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming up on these very same airwaves. Be warned, he's still wearing clothing, but that won't be that way for long, even in this weather. Do enjoy yourselves. Have a great week. And I'll be back next week with, I don't know what yet, but it'll be a new year.
Call me, but you want me in prison, cause I'm busy attacking the flag. I ragging and snagging and dragging and ripping to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
Great show this morning, Jim Frank. 6 minutes after 3 o'clock, you're in tune to Roger's station, WBAI, 99.5 FM, New York, WBAI.org. List Alive, 99 Sinker. We'll do this until 5 o'clock. The flag burning thing where we burn imperialist red, white, and blue of glory to ashes with no apologies. You know, for all the war crimes and a million and one political reasons, not just for sport. 212-209-2900. No, that used to be my social security number. The number is 917-580-6020. Tony Ryan's social security number right here. Tony Ryan, you cuddle up with him, wet panty style on a late Saturday, going into Sunday morning, you know, that kind of thing, right? Yeah. 99 Cinco, List Alive. And if you're just joining us, this is a Boxing Day party. Yeah, so we do it. Yesterday and today, so we do it. Lloyd D. Aguilar is in town. You should be behind the microphones and I'm fine. Cinco. What are you doing, Lloyd? You're supposed to be here. 917-580-6020, the number to burn.